Bizet's Carmen Suite No. 1. The Montreal Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Charles Dutoit. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I'll be here during the week with Essential Classics. Sir Simon Rattle will be my proms artist of the week. And the Essential CD is courtesy of the pianist Myung-Hoon Chung. Next Sunday, James Johnny is back with his own choice selection. I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, enjoy your listening and do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan was a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production today by Lyndon Jones.
Drama on 3 presents August 1914 by Alexander Solzhenitsyn and starring Fiona Shaw and Alex Waldman.
Poland, the middle of August, 1914.
I knew that an imperialist war would break out.
Give the colonel what he needs, Colonel
Vorotintsev, sir.
How long can they keep a barrage like this going for?
For Russia, World War I began with catastrophe.
If we're defeated, there will be an upheaval.
And ended in revolution.
Lenin and his family have reached the main station in Krakow.
Seize the moment! Transform this war into a civil war!
There's no going back. Life will never be the same now.
Drama on 3 is August 1914 by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. This evening at 9:40 here on BBC Radio 3.
And now it's time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest today is the materials scientist Mark Miodovnik.
From concrete to chocolate and from teacups to tennis rackets, it's the everyday stuff of life that fascinates Mark Miodovnik. He's Professor of Materials and Society at University College London, where he's also Director of the Institute of Making, a research hub for scientists, designers, engineers, artists, architects, and musicians. A passionate communicator about the vital role of science in society, he's written a best-selling book, Stuff Matters. He's the scientist in residence on the Dara O'Brien Science Club on BBC Two, and he's listed by The Times as one of the 100 most influential scientists in the UK. Mark, your fascination with materials began in a rather grisly, dramatic way, didn't it?
It did, yes. I got stabbed on the tube, on Hammersmith Station, in fact. It's very odd to think that, you know, in broad daylight, and it was, and I was a schoolboy at the time, that you just get stabbed. Mm. But, of course, there's a lot of that about today as well. In fact, it's actually got worse in that sense. But it was the stabbing that made me really feel like this environment around me, these stuff around us, is not a kind of backdrop to our lives. It's one of the main characters. And in particular, I found out, when I went to the police station, they called the guy, that it was a razor blade, a tiny little postage stamp piece of metal that had done such damage and could have killed me. Mm. And I just became really... I wanted to know where this stuff came from, who made it, how it came into being, what made it tick.
So it might be going a bit too far to say this, but in one way, the guy did you a favour.
I suppose... When I look back on my life, and I suppose everyone does, you can either think of these things as terrible things that happened to you that you survive, or that they moulded you. And I suppose you're moulded more by disaster and disappointment and failure than you are by success, arguably. Or at least, perhaps, that's how I look at it that way anyway.
So if we took the razor blade as just a small example, where might that take you in your thought process?
Well, because razor blades are made of steel... Steel is a material that really has shaped the modern world. But also, you know, it's very intimate material. People use it every day in their bathrooms to shave themselves. And actually, their ability to shave themselves, and in the case of men, let's say, be clean-shaven, is a very important social ritual. You can argue quite strongly that our discovery of metals and transforming them is really who we are. It's our biggest achievement as humans.
Now, your first piece of music takes us to your childhood and rather happier associations than that journey on the tube, I'm glad to say.
Yes. I went to an odd school, and then it took me a long time to kind of find my feet in terms of what I was interested in. And then I sort of latched on to sort of physics and chemistry and maths as these things I found enjoyable. And I could only do my homework if I listened to classical music. And it was weird. Like, people thought, well, that must disturb you. And my parents were kind of concerned and wanting me to turn it off and work properly. But actually, I found it incredibly important to my thought process. It got me in the mood. So even now, when I, you know, listen to this piece of Bach, I'm back there taking my A-levels. And, you know, I can see formula running in front of my eyes. I can see equations. I can see structure. Thank you.
Benjamin Britten conducting the English Chamber Orchestra in the first movement of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 6 in B-flat major. I mentioned, Mark Miedovnik, that you work with musicians at the Institute of Making, and I wonder what kind of research you've done with them.
What we really want to emphasise is that the material world is as complex as you want it to be. There is sort of infinite depth there. And when it comes to music, there are these things called instruments, obviously, that you play, which are this sort of the intermediate, right, between the person and the music. And they make the music, but they're not the whole story. And trying to work out what the character of individual materials are was something that we've been obsessed with for some time. And so decided to try and kind of create a grammar of that, but a material grammar of it. And, of course, instrument makers know this stuff, but we kind of took a different line. So we took a tuning fork and said, well, OK, a normal tuning fork, people just think of the note, let's say 440 hertz, an A, but it's made of steel. Now, why is it made of steel? What makes that the right material for that tuning fork?
Could it be made of something else?
Well, that's what we did. We decided we'd exactly keep the shape the same, but we'll change it into other materials.
So I've got, you brought some examples here.
I've got them here. So this is a tuning fork made of steel. This is an A, so I can play that. And it's got a very pure tone. It's partly to do with the geometry, but also the material, as you'll see, because as soon as you change the material, so if you make that out of copper, for instance, here it is, exactly the same shape, but now it's pure copper, and this is what you get. So you get a different frequency. And that's because the frequency of the instrument is to do with how much it vibrates. And you don't think of the atomic structure of materials, but they're all made of atoms. And those atoms are bonded together, and they're like little springs. And, of course, if you try and wrench them out of their state, they try to spring back. And it's that spring constant that gives you the spring back, which it gives you the vibration. So if that's a very elastic material, it will spring back very fast.
Well, that's,
and you'll get high frequency.
That's not unlike what happens in our ears when the hairs in the inner ear vibrate, don't they?
It's exactly the same.
So what other... I can't resist having
I know, but it's a little bit of... I mean, one of the things you notice from the copper is it's not just a different frequency, which is to do with the spring constant and the density, but also it's a different tone. I mean, I mean tonal quality. I don't mean tone in terms of frequency. So if you do zinc, so here's zinc, right? And it's almost completely inert. It's very hard to get a sound out of it. It's a very soft metal. Now add copper and zinc together, and you have something called brass. This is a brass tuning fork. Now that's incredibly bright. And of course, you know, you immediately think of brass instruments, bells, and that's the reason. So why does some material sustain a note for longer than others? And what's the magic behind the fact that you take two things, copper and zinc, which were both quite dull. Zinc was almost inaudible and copper was dull. And you add them together and you get something that's resonant, much more resonant than steel. That's really magic.
You've even got wood, haven't you?
We've got wood, yeah.
Does that sound at all? I
mean... Yes. So this is spruce, which of course is a very good material for instruments, often used for violins or violas. Yeah. Now, this absorbs sound very quickly. And, of course, that's an advantage to instrument makers. You know, you think what you want is something that's very resonant. But when you look at the woods, what you have essentially are foams. They're mostly air. And why is that advantageous? Well, because if you're playing lots of different notes in a row, you don't want each one to be constantly ringing as the next one plays. So what you're looking for is, I mean, this is a very simplistic way of looking at instrument, but you're looking for a note to be true, to have lots of harmonics, but then to die away at a particular rate. And controlling that is what makes a great instrument maker.
You've actually got a bit of music now, which I suppose demonstrates your fascination and the lengths you go to actually try things out yourself, because this is a musical saw, isn't it?
Yes. My missus plays the saw, and it's something that when we met, I was I couldn't believe it, really, because I've always been fascinated with the saw and never met anyone who'd... played it, and to fall in love with her at the same time has a special, you know, resonance for me. And it's from a film called Delicatessen, this piece, which is a materials film. I don't know how many people have seen this film. It's a French film. It's quite old now, but it is a materials film, if you ask me, because it's all about the character of the house and all the things in it that play a very important role, including the saw.
Well, it's by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, I think, the film was made by, wasn't it? And he made Amélie, and the music is by Carlo D'Alessio. The duo for cello and saw from Carlos D'Alessio's score for the 1991 film Delicatessen. The interesting thing there, I think, Mark Medovnik, is that using natural materials, you can get a sound which other composers have struggled to get electronically on the theremin or the Ond Martineau. And yet, a saw is simply played, isn't it, with a bow, as though you were playing a string.
Electronic music is interesting too, but with an electronic music, you've got to pick out every single frequency and you've got to then get them to talk to each other to get something that to the human ear sounds that will respond to you, let's say. And with a material object, those all come for free.
You just bend the saw, yeah, don't you? And it changes the pitch.
But all the complexity of the material comes out in the sound. It is all in there. What you're doing is you're releasing it. And so, again, it's this expression of an inner life. In this case, an inner life of a saw. You know, I love all that stuff too. I love the electronic world, but it's always responding to this physical world. Because when you're a kid, when you first start to explore the world, you have to work it all out. You start touching things and banging things. And if I hit this glass of the door of the studio, you instantly know what that material is. In fact, human ears have picked up all these complex harmonics of materials, characters, their signatures. You can even tell, by the way, whether water being poured into a cup of tea is hot or cold. I mean, human ears are brilliant at being able to tell just the difference of a temperature.
That's amazing. I hadn't thought of that. Does your wife still play the saw?
Yes. Yeah.
And do you have duets together?
No, we don't, unfortunately, because I can't play the cello. But there's something I need to be, you know, I need to get on that. You're absolutely right.
Mark, did you grow up in a musical family?
We played classical music. It was, in fact, the only thing that was on in my house. I think it was my mum who insisted on this. And that's because I went to a school where they banned pop music. So not only were we not allowed to listen to pop music at school or even refer to it, but all the parents kind of towed the line and didn't play pop music at home. So the only thing that was on in my house when I was growing up was classical music.
Was that because it was considered pop music was dangerous or...?
Yes, that's what they thought. It's dangerous, corrupting. I was born in 1969, so I was growing up in the 70s, and they thought that pop music was going to corrupt my mind and my
Of course, those of us that know lots of classical music can mention pieces that are extremely corrupting.
And I should hope so too.
The next short piece comes from immediately after you left home and I think went to university and discovered film.
You know that thing where you leave the environment which you're familiar with and then you have to kind of make your way in the world, and suddenly, you know, film is that window into that other world, the many possibilities of ways you could live your life, you know, because you can see a lot more films than you can actually have lives. And also the darkness of the cinema is something magical to me. And I remember going to see Jeux de Fête, which is a Jacques Tati film, and just thinking, oh my goodness, what a world that I could live in. It seemed like a very pure world of rural life in France, and how, again, this is the sort of animation of the inanimate that he specialises in Jacques Tati. He's a master of it, in fact, that the little details of the world which you don't notice, he brings out things like bicycles and windows and cars. And, you know, he really, he's the kind of patron saint of the inanimate in some ways.
So as we listen to this, what should we imagine image-wise?
Cycling through a country road in France on a bicycle, and how the bicycle itself is as animate as a horse or as a cow. You know, he really kind of brings the mechanical into the everyday.
John Yatov's opening music from Jacques Tati's film Jour de Fête. You went on, Mark, to your PhD at Oxford, and I think you did research on jet engine alloys, which have had quite a big effect on the cost of flight for all of us.
Yes, the bit I worked on is when you're getting onto a plane, you see this engine underneath the wing, and you see this big fan.
Hopefully.
If it's still there, no, but on the ground when it hasn't taken off yet. That metal, those metal turbines, and you can think of them as fans, they have to get up to, you know, temperatures of 1,100, 1,200 degrees. Now, they're way over the melting point of the metals. So these metals should just melt. It's incredible. So they're designed to be, you know, high strength at these high temperatures you can possibly get. But then they also have all these different coatings. They have internal structures that cool them. They really are a modern miracle. And without them, flight would be extraordinarily expensive. It would be something you could do maybe once a year, if that. And so the jet engine is the most efficient engine on the planet. And it is what made everybody be able to have a holiday in the sun.
Let's just return to that Oxford period. Now, one might imagine that as somebody interested in metals, a group of scientists might be listening to heavy metal, but not you. You were listening to Handel.
Yes. I guess I was still in that period where I really needed it, you know. I really needed it. It was a fuel for me. And it was the only way I could get into the mood of being someone who lived equations in their head. It made me a better scientist. I'm absolutely convinced of that. The diet of classical music I had at Oxford. And of course, it's steeped in it, you know. And the amount of classical music that goes on in that university town is immense. That it's, you know, every night of the week you can go to a concert. That's incredible. What an honour.
So this music that you've chosen is what exactly?
So this is Handel. It's just one of those pieces that makes me kind of daydream.
It's a saraband,
yeah,
isn't it? Which,
yes,
is a sort of dance, stately dance. And this is an orchestral version of a movement from the keyboard suite in D minor.
Thank you.
has a wonderful, stately kind of gravity to it, doesn't it, that music?
Yeah, but there's a sort of danger lurking.
Ominous, somewhere.
Yeah,
ominous.
Yeah, there's ominous. It's the unpredictability again that I get from that piece.
That Saraban by Handel was an orchestral version of a movement from his keyboard suite in D minor, and it was performed by the Leopoldinum Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Karol Teutsch. You mentioned brass earlier, and now we're going to hear a brass band, aren't we?
Yes. I did my PhD in Oxford, and in the same lab was a guy called Andy Godfrey, who's a trombone player. And when he handed it, so I don't know, if you haven't written a PhD before, it's sort of hell. It kind of starts off great and then it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And it's one of those things, it's not like an exam where it will come to an end and however well you do, you have to finish it. If you don't finish it, it just doesn't get finished. And he handed it in, and a bit later I handed mine in. But when he handed his in, he got his mates to turn up at the place, the registration place. And usually what happens is you hand in this enormous piece of work that's meant so much to you and you've struggled over and it's made you who you are. And someone just goes, thanks very much, and puts it into a brown envelope. But he knew that was going to happen and it would be disappointing. So he got his mates to turn up and they serenaded him with a brass band. And they followed him around the city of Oxford playing. And I just thought, you know, the theatre of life, you know, sometimes it needs a bit of a hand. You know, sometimes fact is stranger than fiction, but sometimes you need to inject a bit of fiction into your life.
And this is very much this music, isn't it, that we're going to hear? Very much the kind of positive side of the Industrial Revolution. And one thinks of brass bands in the coal mines, one thinks in the North in particular, singing in the coal mines, of course, as well. But this is a natural expression.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I'd say that it tells you also that, you know, the Industrial Revolution is part of our culture, you know, in the same way that music is, and that sciences and engineering, they really come together in this piece by Holst.
Thank you. The last movement of Gustav Holst's Moorside Suite, performed by the Grimthorpe Colliery RJB Band under the direction of Gary Cutt. And by the way, you can find details of all Mark Miodovnik's music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Your next music, I think, really comes from your love of film, but it also reminds you of a period of your life when I believe you were working in the desert in the US in a nuclear weapons lab, which all sounds a bit Dr. Strangelove to me.
Well, actually, yes, quite Dr. Strangelove. I was working in a nuclear weapons lab in America, and it's in the middle of the desert, and I had this house up on the hill, and every morning I got up and it was bright sunshine and there was blue skies and there were cactus there, and every morning. And it was like living on a different planet, really. And also because of the work, very strange place to be, all top secret, that kind of thing. And otherworldly is kind of just a cliche, really. I mean, there's just this sense that this place hasn't been lived in and that it's all to play for. And Ennio Morricone really, you know, his music is really, I think he does deserts and kind of building a life in a kind of desolate place. He does it better than anyone. It really brings that whole thing to life, and you realise that it's so dangerous out there. I mean, it's, you know, the sun beats down, you can get lost, won't be found, there's nothing out there. It's an extraordinary place.
Il buono, il cattivo, il brutto. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. Better known to most of us as the good, the bad and the ugly. The opening music from Ennio Morricone's soundtrack to Sergio Leone's 1966 film. And there was a wonderful example, Mark, of using all kinds of different sounds, natural and where things had been created especially to make those sounds.
Yeah, he creates a soundscape that is completely like nothing you've ever heard before, and so therefore the place he's describing is something that's out of your... Yeah, your
and
experience.
It's very fascinating to me that your passion for actually making things and your belief that making things should really be at the heart of our culture and at the heart of our education system. I think you said that you think public libraries should be turned into public workshops. And what sort of things should people be making?
It doesn't really matter what they make. They can make clothes, they can make musical instruments, they can make jewellery, they can make machines, cars, rockets. It's the act of making itself is part of what human defines what it is to human. And we've lost it. And I think that if you can imagine a country in which no one plays music anymore, how much that would be just bafflingly barren as a culture.
So making music would qualify.
You're making music definitely qualifies.
Reading your book, Stuff Matters, it does strike me that you're part scientist, part philosopher, in that you're wanting us to think in a different way about the material world we live in and to appreciate the everyday things around us. And I was particularly struck by your description of the properties of wrapping paper, a material we generally take rather for granted. But I'd love you just to read this little passage to give a flavour of it.
Yeah, I'd be delighted.
It's on that bit of paper.
Yes, it is. Fantastic material. Paper's mechanical properties lend themselves to folding and bending. The cellulose fibres of which it is made can be partially snapped in the area of maximum bend, allowing a permanent crease to form, while sufficient fibres remain intact for the material not to crack and fall apart. This winning combination of mechanical properties allows it to assume the shape of any object through creasing and folding. Hence the art of origami. Wrapping a present with paper gives it a crispness and a pristineness that emphasises the newness and the value of the present inside. Paper is strong enough to protect the present during transportation, but so weak that even a baby can rip it open.
I must say, somebody whose present wrapping is of the most dire sort you can imagine. It looks like a shirt that's just come back from the laundry and not been ironed. But does it ever drive you slightly mad, not being able to take everyday things for granted?
Yeah, it's an obsession.
It's a creative obsession.
Yeah, but like all obsessions, it drives you mad. And every year I take August off to try and get out of it, to try and kind of just restore a kind of my brain into some other mode, because I think it's important to do that. I think obsession does drive you towards creativity, actually. I think there's a madness that you have to kind of tap into, and this constant interrogation of the world is part of that. But then as July goes through and I get closer and closer to holiday times, I realise that I'm taut like a sort of string. I'm kind of ready to snap.
Well, we're going to allow that string to bend a little bit as we explore your more emotional side, because this is from Rigoletto. Tell me about it and why it touches you so much.
Well, I got into opera and I couldn't, you know, again, this is a sort of marriage of the theatre and music. And I'm a big fan of the fact that you can't, you know, people sort of say, oh, you've got to be realistic. And I just don't think you have to be realistic. I think, in fact, that's a really dangerous thing to be realistic, because the world's a very complex and weird place. And realism almost has no part to play in interpreting it. You've got to be theatrical in your life. You've got to see yourself as a character in this kind of wonderful play. And I think opera really does that to you, because it's so ludicrous a space, isn't it?
So you have to enter into
yes,
its world,
you
or,
have to.
Or you're lost.
Yeah. Exactly. And it teaches you to do that. And people who see opera differently, they see opera as a kind of crazy, anachronistic form, I think haven't kind of worked it out, that the rest of life's also like that. So, I mean, I love opera for that. And going to it makes me kind of, yeah, really appreciate.
Rigoletto has a particular power, I think, because as it's a favourite theme of Verdi, which perhaps echoes something in his own life, the love of a father for the daughter.
Yeah.
And in this case, the daughter is taken advantage of by a licentious duke. And Rigoletto, who has kind of machinated slightly and everything turns round on him, and there's an appalling moment at the end when he has the dying daughter in his arms. And this music comes from there, I think.
It does, yeah. Yeah. And that thing where you kind of, where you've done it, you know, that moment in all of our lives where we reflect, did we do this to ourselves? You know, the position I'm in now, is that because I did, you know, we've all been there, and this is the ultimate moment. This is the moment where, you know, you've killed your own daughter by, or that's what he thinks. And in some ways, you have to say that it appears to be true, you know, that he's responsible in some way for her death by his pride and his wanting to get one over on these people who've always thought him as unworthy and and rather a figure of ridicule, and he's wanted to get back on them, and he's got this beautiful daughter, and even that has failed. It's terrible.
It's awful, isn't it? It's completely shattering.
And you relive it each time, don't you? And you think, what would it be like to have done that?
Yeah. The final scene from Verdi's Rigoletto, with Renato Brusson as Rigoletto and Edita Gruberova as Gilda. Giuseppe Sinopoli was conducting the orchestra of the National Academy of St. Cecilia. What do you think, Mark, are the most exciting current developments in material science? And what's going to change our world?
Well, I think that two themes, one of which is about the body, and I think the 21st century is going to be about redesigning the human body. That sounds a bit kind of Frankensteinian, crazy talk, but actually I think it comes from a very important angle, which is that we're now getting to the point where it can grow parts of the body.
Human tissue.
For replacement. And actually, if you think about what old age really means to people, actually, it's a terrible, tragic moment in your life where you start to lose your faculties, you start to lose your independence, and you start to become frail. And to be able to offer someone the ability to live their life out in their own home, fully able to kind of cook and wash themselves and be an active part in life, you know, up to the age of 90, 100, right? Replace the cartilage in your knee, replace, you know, get rid of arthritis, be able to give someone a new liver, like grow it for them. These things are going to happen. and it's going to be great. I really, you know, I'm an unallied fan of this. I think people are going to really have a new lease of life in their 60s and 70s as a result of this. So that's all happening and that's great. The other big drive is going to be trying to do something about global warming. We need to stop burning fossil fuels for lots of reasons, one of which is because of the global warming issue, but the other is because they're just too useful to burn, right? And we need to harvest our energy from the sun. And solar cells are, you know, the human equivalent of the leaf. And in the next 20 or 30 years, I'm absolutely convinced that we will be able to get enough energy from the sun to satiate our our thirst, you know, for being able to travel around the world and do great things and talk to each other.
And do you have any ideas as to how music might be affected by science changes and materials?
Maybe not music, but certainly our soundscape. I think that what's going to happen is, just as this studio is lined with foam, which is deadening the sound and stopping it rebounding off us. If you think about it, most the built environment is built, you know, with irrelevance to what sound's going to do to it. So people, if you live in a house with stone floors, you know when someone's come in the house with shoes on, you can hear it. But I think designing materials that will be tunable acoustically is now possible, and it will happen more and more. So you might have a restaurant in which, when it's hardly anyone in it, they'll tune up the brightness, and so it'll sound quite busy. But as soon as it becomes full and you can't even hear yourself chat to your mate, they'll turn up the absorption. And those kind of things will then be tools that musicians can take and do what they want with. But there's a big driving force for things like architecture. And of course, in cars, like cars have got so much quieter now. That's because of all this sort of new technology in terms of manipulating sound, deadening sound.
Fascinating. Let's play out on something which I think you particularly love. It was actually used in a film, but that's not why you've chosen it.
It helps me, this piece of music. It's Scott Joplin. And in some ways, it's sort of my heartbeat in a way. This rhythm is kind of the rate at which I, as an organism, kind of go, right? You know, if my life is sort of somewhere between ridiculousness on one side and passionate on the other, this hits right in the middle. This is my normal state of affairs walking down the road.
Well, it's the entertainer that we're going to hear. So thank you, Mark Miodovnik, for entertaining us with your private passions.
That's been a pleasure being here. Thank you.
Scott Joplin, playing the entertainer, ending that edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest was the materials scientist Mark Miodovnik. The programme is produced by Jane Greenwood for Loftus. And you might like to know that you can download that programme and many more besides if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the writer Sophie Hanna.
At this year's BBC Proms, dip into the music of the man who brought us this. And this. 150 years ago this year, the composer Richard Strauss was born. And throughout the 2014 BBC Proms, you can hear a feast of his music.
Last night, Donald Runnicles led the Deutsche Oper Berlin and Nina Stemmer in Salome. Listen again via the Proms website. This evening, Christina Gurka is Electra in Strauss's powerful retelling of the Greek revenge myth. Join me, Andrew McGregor, for Electra by Richard Strauss, live from the Royal Albert Hall this evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
And we're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. Ministers are considering a ban on British-born Muslims returning home if they've gone to fight for extremists in Syria and Iraq. Those suspected of being involved in terrorist acts would be able to keep their British citizenship, but be banned temporarily from re-entering the country. The Prime Minister is expected to announce the details tomorrow. The Iraqi military says its forces have broken a siege by Islamic State fighters of a town in the north of the country. Thousands of people in Amirli have been trapped for 2 months with dwindling supplies of food. Last night, two RAF Hercules aircraft dropped supplies into the town. Police in Hampshire have begun extradition proceedings against a couple from Portsmouth who removed their young son, who has brain cancer, from hospital and took him to their home in Spain. Asher King's father, Brett King, said his son had not been receiving the treatment his family wanted in hospital in England. President Putin has said talks on ending the conflict in eastern Ukraine must include discussions on statehood for the region. Speaking on Russian television, he also said Moscow would not stand aside while people were being shot and that the West's support for Ukrainian military operations was against European democratic values. Police in Cumbria have confirmed that the bodies of two people have been found in burned-out buildings in the Lake District. The fire service was called to a blaze near Windermere yesterday afternoon. China has ruled out open nominations for the election of Hong Kong's leader in 2017. All candidates must first obtain the backing of what officials called a broadly representative committee. Pro-democracy activists have threatened to stage a campaign of civil disobedience against the decision. Retailers are reporting a surge in the sale of vacuum cleaners in the past 2 weeks. Consumers are concerned about new rules being brought in tomorrow, limiting the production and import of high-powered machines. And the weather, it'll be a mostly fine and warm day with light winds and sunny spells. BBC News and weather at 1:03. Well now, a second opportunity to hear last Monday's Proms Chamber Music Concert. It took place at Cadogan Hall in London and was given by Radio 3 New Generation artists, the Royal String Quartet, joined by the pianist Louis Schwitzgebel and three players from Poland. I have to say, though, that the eight musicians never actually all performed together, so more about them as we go along. We'll hear first a solo from Louis Schwitzgebel in Mozart's Sonata K311. It's been suggested that it was with this sonata that Mozart truly found his own musical voice, experimenting with new structures, abandoning convention and fully realising the potential of the piano as a solo instrument. It's in D major, a happy, optimistic key, and it's interesting to note that Mozart was at this time free from the control of his overbearing father.